dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I've admired greatly for a long time is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm very proud to say. He is also the host of an extraordinarily important program on Blaze TV. It's called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is the author of two best-selling books, Game Plan and Secret Weapon, and the driving force behind a terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. His name is, of course, Kevin Freeman. He's a regular here. We're always delighted to have him with us, especially at a moment when so much is going on in, well, the economic domain and arguably the economic warfare one as well. Kevin, it's good to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us. So we are watching high drama play out at the moment, Kevin Freeman, in Washington, D.C., where we are having legislators issuing various pieces of legislation that are increasing enormously the amounts of money available for various purposes, supposedly related to alleviating the COVID-19 or Chinese flu pandemic in this country, economically and societally. Give us a flavor, if you could, from the perspective of a serious economist, what this is likely to mean for the country longer term.
Well, Frank, you know, we've watched this political process really run amok in Washington, where we're adding in all sorts of things that never belonged in a bill. And I don't know where it stands exactly now. I don't think they've signed it. They've just agreed to it in the Senate as we're talking.
I'm not sure any of them know what's in it, as a matter of fact, as I'll be discussing with Diana West shortly.
Yeah, and there's some crazy things that have been put in there, which, you know, literally a Democrat takeover of the rest of the country forever by ballot harvesting and all sorts of things. But putting that aside, there are serious issues here. We're talking, I think Larry Kudlow talked about $6 trillion of potential relief, $2 trillion in direct aid and $4 trillion in additional lending pattern. What that translates to is a massive, we're talking, the U.S. economy is you know, roughly a $20 trillion a year economy. So one-third of the economy put in additional promises or bailouts or whatever, that will have an impact on the economy short-term, and I think it'll provide a lot of relief. But the second-order effects of that, if not handled extremely carefully, are very dangerous, and they're not taking that into account, as far as I can tell, in their pushing through $6 trillion.
Give us an example of what second-order effects you're thinking of.
First off, someone's going to have to buy the debt. You're going to borrow money and you're going to put it out there. Who's going to buy it? What country of the world has the capacity at this moment to buy U.S. Treasury bonds? Now, a lot of them do. There's a big flight to safety push. A lot of people are saying, well, I want the safest asset on the planet. And so they go to gold or they go to U.S. Treasury bonds. But what happens is that sucking money that would otherwise be available for capital enterprise in other places, it's put safe money. And one of two things is going to happen is it's either going to slow down the economy because it's sucking out $6 trillion over the long run. We're borrowing from tomorrow to take care of today. Or we're going to monetize that, meaning print money is the term that people will use, but although we don't really print money that way, but we're creating new money supply. And that is a very strong risk to the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. And something we've talked about numerous times on this program.
We have indeed. There is, at the same moment that we are looking to perhaps China, but certainly others around the world to help float this enormous stimulus package, increasing talk, Kevin, of trying to punish the Chinese for their role in inflicting this pandemic upon us. specifically some kind of reparations. I don't know that this has gotten past the very generic talk stage at the moment in Washington or any place else, but what are your thoughts about that idea? It's appealing, seems warranted and justified. I just wanted to get your thoughts on how might that work mechanically.
Well, it's very complex. It's hard to do both. How do you punish someone at the same time you ask them to support you? And how do you punish or ask for support from a nation that is undeniably hard hit from this? The Chinese Communist Party will be under enormous stress. I doubt that the statistics that indicate that they've gotten the virus under control are accurate or real. The repercussions in China are going to be severe. The Communist Party is not going to have excess funds, and they're going to be have a call on all of those funds from everywhere they've invested, Africa or Europe or wherever they've invested. They're going to say, look, if the U.S. gets reparations, we want it too. Or they're going to say, hey, we're your ally, support us financially. I can't see how the Chinese Communist Party will be in a position to buy additional U.S. treasuries. And at the same time, we have this push from Vladimir Putin and China and other places. Let's de-dollarize. Let's not come out of this crisis dependent on the U.S. dollar. So, of course, they're not going to be interested in buying our debt.
You have a program with an old friend of mine, Dr. Gal Luft, at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, that is out this week, as I understand it, on Blaze TV. Remind us how people can watch that program, Kevin, and what you and Gal discussed that's relevant to what we're just going over here.
Yeah, that's episode 79, and you can find it at economicwarroom.com as a starting point if you're not already a subscriber to Blaze TV. If you go to Blaze TV, use the code ECON, E-C-O-N. But the title is De-dollarization, the best way to destroy America is to destroy the currency. And we start out, this is a Vladimir Lenin idea that if you want to destroy a capitalist economy, debase the currency, make the currency worthless. And one easy way to do that is to print $6 trillion additional money. Another way is to stop accepting that currency overseas. And both of those trends are in play, and we're not noticing them to the same degree right now, but that is the second order effect.
And to the extent that the Russians and Chinese actually have an alternative to the dollar in mind, what would that be, Kevin Freeman? Their own currencies are not generally sought after, are they?
And that's the good news. The good news is that at present, the dollar is the cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry. It's dirty, but it's cleaner than all the others. So it's the one you pick up and wear. But they are creating alternatives, including digital currency alternatives. And that's why it's so dangerous when we see in the stimulus package this idea, well, we'll just create a U.S. digital currency. All of a sudden, other nations will create other currencies. And if you move to a digital currency system, who do you want to run it? Should the United States run it? Or remember when we asked to have all of the governing bodies of the internet moved out internationally and they shouldn't be American controlled? There will be an international push, even by our allies, to not have America in the driver's seat of an international alliance for digital currencies.
And one thing we've learned is that the Chinese have proven very adept at taking over those international bodies. And if they don't do it directly, indirectly, as with the World Health Organization, we're watching play out just how devastating that can be. Kevin Freeman, we are hard out of time. I'm sorry to say there's so much more to discuss. I thank you tremendously for the work you do for us at the Center, but also at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Do find out how you can watch not just Program 79, but all of the terrific programming that Kevin has generated there at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, God bless you. Stay well, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak, as promised, with Diana West about this legislation, the process, the polity that may be very adversely affected by it, namely ours. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Diana West, the fabulous longtime columnist, extraordinarily accomplished author, and essayist, notably at dianawest.net. To her credit, she has three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Diana, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back. I'm keen to get your current reading on the state of the war, as Donald Trump is now, I think, rightly called it, the war against the Chinese virus, the war against what it is unleashing in our country, both in terms of the economic devastation, the social upheaval, and perhaps the lasting, if not permanent, changes in some of our governance institutions, structures, and the freedoms that we're supposed to have under all of that. Give us your reading as you see things at the moment.
Yes, well, as all of us see things at the moment, it's very hard to focus on things that are happening outside of starting with our family health, our neighborhood health, our towns, our nation. I mean, there is a panic abroad in the land that is on one hand very understandable and on the other hand very blinding to all of the things that are going on and all of the things that we are having trouble keeping track of and all of the things that become cover for what we see as rollouts in various areas, various offices, bureaus, departments, countries of New World Order agenda items. I mean, this is something that causes great mistrust among some of us as looking at the motivations behind some of the draconian measures being taken, ostensibly to save our lives, but also always in every turn, eliminating, curbing, perhaps eradicating our normal, hard-won freedoms and liberties as citizens, as human beings. So it's a very difficult time.
Yeah, it is. And it calls to mind Rahm Emanuel's famous line about never letting a crisis go to waste when he was chief of staff at the White House. The Democrats, whether it's Nancy Pelosi in the House or Chuck Schumer in the Senate or governors around the country, mayors, seem quite intent, as you say, on parlaying the understandable public health emergency into lasting advances for their fundamental transformation of America, as Barack Obama famously called it back in 2008. Talk a little bit about this legislation, Diana, that has been working its way through the Congress today. A breakthrough was accomplished early in the morning hours and is now, as we speak, in imminent prospect of passage by the Senate and I guess by the House. By the time this airs, this story will be known. But as we talk at the moment, Diana, what's your reading on the damage being done to our polity, to our sovereignty, perhaps, to our freedoms?
Well, from what we know of it, it is another public emergency in terms of this kind of seizure of power. Decimation of our voting process is written into it. We've got DACA sneaking into it. I mean, I don't even know all of the terrible things that have gone into that bill that was supposed to address this extremely unusual emergency being felt by Americans across the land.
But sadly, nobody knows. Apparently.
Nobody knows. It's one of those things. I'd like to step back from it for just a second to just sort of pull back on the focus of the frame here, because I'm still kind of stuck on how we even got to this position of world a pandemic possibilities. And when we look at the period of impeachment, we were all focused on the impeachment in January to early February, while our health experts, people who are supposed to deal with infectious diseases, for example, Dr. Fauci at the Natural Institutes of Health, the World Health Organization, and its constant monitoring of these sorts of things, they were at work doing what they were supposed to do, and what they were doing was, in effect, ensuring that we would have an international infectious outbreak by railing against the notion of travel restrictions, which fortunately President Trump did enact by the end of January, even as he was in the midst of impeachment. Thank you, President Trump, for being able to do two things at once. The Dr. Fauci minimizing the risk of this, looking at what was going on in China and issuing statements to the media about how this was not going to, the risk to Americans was very low. Again, this notion of China rolling out thousands and thousands of travelers throughout the world. In December alone, we had thousands and thousands of people from Wuhan arriving in the United States, for example. Already the infection was raging in China. this is where I start really worrying about, we know about the synergy between the World Health Organization and China. We know about the New World Order aspects of World Health, the United Nations, the Global Fund, these kinds of mechanisms that are moving us into this New World Order world where we are perhaps vaccinated with identity chips and things like that. I mean, this is kind of the nightmare ahead of the democratic legislation that, again, we focus on one thing at a time. But look at this larger frame up. If indeed we have a situation where world health officials and national health officials were downplaying the dangers and preventing countries from enacting travel restrictions, which should have been done right away, we have a real talk about emergency. We have an emergency created that we are now dealing with, that the Democrats then step to because they have the same kinds of political aspirations, and we are now facing this real threat. And this is why it does pain me to see people managing the health crisis, the corona crisis in America, who are in and of that same global health order. And that would include Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci and others who come from this global health background for the last many decades, moving toward, you know, ID 2020 and, you know, think this is something Bill Gates is part of, these global mechanisms of vaccination and health, world health controlled by the World Health Organization, which seems to be controlled by China. So there are a lot of moving parts here. And then we get to the Democratic Party perfidy in terms of hammering the domestic agenda forward, utterly gutting Republican chances of election chances. This is something that our friend Richard Viguerie is writing about today with the little gifts inside the COVID-19 bill, the Wuhan virus bill, to make voting by mail a norm, to make ID, you know, voter ID, outlaw this. I mean, these are the kinds of things in the bill as it's emerging. So there are a lot of problems here to deal with, and they're not just right ones in front of our nose, I guess is what I'm saying. There's a lot of agendas in play.
Well, it's very troubling, that's for sure, especially when, as I discussed with Congressman Louis Gohmert on Monday, the legislative process has simply left the rails. The kind of debate and scrutiny of legislation and accountability for what's in legislation is a thing of the past. Louis talked about finding that, you know, after the House had adopted an earlier version of this emergency legislation, it was being substantially rewritten by staff, and nobody knew what they were doing. And it was all supposed to be voice voted or even unanimous consent. And to Louis' great credit, he interposed some objections to it. Diana, let me turn to one other piece of this, which I know from our previous conversations has to be worrying to you as well. You have been very skeptical about Attorney General William Barr. I must say I have tended to find what he's done to this point, by and large, commendable. I am somewhat troubled, though, I have to say, and I imagine you are as well, about a legislative request made of the Congress by the Department of Justice that would substantially erode some of our due process rights and criminal and civil processes. And I just wonder, as you're talking about the sort of mutation of the world order or even our own governance arrangements, where does this prospect fit in as you see it?
Well, it's as dark as it can be, and it absolutely must be turned down, this notion of suspending those very precious rights. There, again, I must commend a number of doctors, medical professors around the world who are stepping up and trying to inject a rational measure for understanding the impact on humanity of coronavirus. People, you know, who obviously are under pressure by the juggernaut to make this the new great plague, with trying to at least make us say, we don't know, we don't have the data to change our society to fight this disease. with any kind of certainty at this point. It is beyond crazy to completely destroy our society to fight a virus that may indeed, as we pan out over the next weeks, months, certainly, but even very soon, understanding the actual threat it does pose to people, rather than absolutely tank our liberties, tank our societies, tank our economies, and create more misery, suffering, and death, I will add, as a result. So again, this takes us back to the beginning of our conversation, looking at how all the measures taken, whether it's by William Barr and the Justice Department with this kind of outrageous demand, essentially suspending habeas corpus and other protections, and the Democratic free-for-all to kind of rewrite everything about our country in this legislation, to looking at other countries and what they are doing, and looking at the World Health Organization, there's a clicking kind of into pattern here that we're seeing that is, again, going back to Rahm Emanuel's great phrase, never letting a crisis go to waste.
We are watching it closely, as are you, my dear. Dinah West, thank you for your time today. We will look forward to another stock taking next week. I hope that it will be a little bit more cheerful, but I'm anxious about it, I have to say, and I know you are as well. We appreciate your visits with us, Dinah. Thank you. Please check out her work at dinahwest.net. Stay well and come back to us again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Bradley Thayer. We'll get a further dive down on what China is doing in the midst of this crisis and what it might mean for all of us next. That coming up straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a professor of political science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. He's been a fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School, and has been a fellow at St. Anthony's College at the University of Oxford. He has worked for the Defense Department and other entities, including one of my personal favorites, the National Institute for Public Policy. He's the author, among other books, of How China Sees the World: Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. Brad Thayer, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir. A lot of water has gone over the dam since we last talked, Brad, and Han Centrism is a topic that is much on my mind, and I wanted to invite you to remind us what that is, and specifically to talk about it in the context of how Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, may be trying to utilize it to call upon sort of the nationalist impulses of many Chinese Han to rally round the Communist Party at a moment when it is in rather low regard for good reasons concerning its malfeasance with respect to this pandemic.
Yes, Frank, excellent question. Han centrism is the belief that many of the Han, the majority, about 92% of the Chinese population, identify as being at the center of the universe, essentially recognizing with a very strong ethnocentric and xenophobic belief that the rest of the world needs to adapt or to be centered around what China wants and what the Han people desired. Its origins are deep within Chinese history. It's not a modern phenomenon, but it's been manipulated, of course, as you observed, by Xi Jinping, and has historically by the Communist Party of China. And so we see many examples of that in the present crisis with the Wuhan virus. We can see that the Chinese have been blaming other countries, including the United States. United States Army, they've claimed, brought it to China itself, or that the Italians, originated in Italy and then centered within to China. And that's in keeping with the Han-centric belief that China does no wrong, it cannot make mistakes, and any problems that it faces are the responsibility of other people, of other groups, of other nations in international politics. And Xi Jinping and the Communist Party of China have been adroit at playing that theme in order to distract attention from their malfeasance, from their incompetence, and the mistakes, intentional mistakes, that they made at the outbreak, of course, in November and then into December, where they actively suppressed information that could have contained this virus far earlier and not have done the damage to China, of course, and to the rest of the world.
And Brad Thayer, do you think that that adroitness is likely to translate into not only fanning the flames of resentment within China towards the rest of the world, and most especially towards the United States, but perhaps into a sort of social engineering, as it's been called, strategy, namely trying to get a foreign boogeyman to be the focus of the ire of the Chinese people rather than the Chinese Communist Party, perhaps to the point where it translates into a provocative action against that boogeyman, namely us, or perhaps Taiwan, which is closer at hand and an easier target.
Indeed, Frank, that's a considerable concern. The idea that the external opponent is generated or touted to deal with the internal tensions within China, of course, is a very real danger. And it harkens to Germany's actions before World War I, where as a result of the tensions within Germany, they touted essentially the animus of Britain and the animus of Russia towards them. It's an old idea, social imperialism, the idea that in order to deal with your internal problems, you go out and make an external foe. Well, we're seeing this in China. We've seen this before in China, but we're seeing it now, of course, with the Wuhan virus. And it's particularly telling at this point because the virus has done such significant damage to China that the party needs, for the sake of its legitimacy and to sustain its legitimacy, it needs to find someone to blame. And it can't blame the Han people. So it's got to go out and find, we mentioned the United States or the Italians or some other external force has to be culpable for it. And this shows the fundamental irresponsibility and danger of the Communist Party of China. And states in those circumstances are prone to taking rash action. And so your concern, I share, that this could encourage the Chinese party to take actions against Taiwan, or to embolden it in actions against other states in the South China Sea, East China Sea, or against India.
We had a long conversation with former Marine Colonel Grant Newsom, another of our colleagues on the Committee on the Present Danger of China, about this yesterday, and I commend it to our listeners. If you didn't catch it, it is well worth taking aboard, because I think we're wise to anticipate that these propagandistic efforts, which offend many of us, rightly so, may have a calculated purpose in China that could be very dangerous indeed. Brad Thayer, you talk about social imperialism. That's such an interesting term. You and Lian Chao Han, another of our committee members, have been contributing mightily in the Hill newspaper, among other places, to some of our understanding of what the Chinese are up to with respect to their Belt and Road Initiative, for example. But also, you've recently written about their penetration, or at least their dominance, of international organizations, in particular the World Health Organization. As with much of what's wrong with China at the moment and our engagement with China, this is a moment when I think people are looking afresh at institutions like the WHO, specifically the conduct of its Director General, Tedros Ghebreyesus. Talk about what the Chinese are up to with respect to the WHO, what has enabled them to do, and the implications of all of that.
Certainly, Frank. It shows, it's a very telling issue. It shows that the Chinese strategy is now paying dividends. The Chinese have penetrated international organizations, as well as all aspects of Western societies and other societies as well. And their close relationship, obviously, with Tedros, the leader of the World Health Organization, is the culmination of that. It shows the dividends that are paid from the Chinese effort to take over international organizations and cause them to bend to the propaganda and the desires and interests of China. So Tedros was China's candidate. He was elected to his position in the World Health Organization in 2017, despite the fact that he's not a medical doctor and he had no global health management experience.
He's a Marxist, right, from Ethiopia.
And a close sympathizer, obviously, with Mugabe, now deceased, former dictator of Zimbabwe, as well as a close relationship with China. and Xi Jinping specifically. And so Tedros and Xi Jinping have worked hand in glove to suppress information completely at odds with the mission of the World Health Organization.
And in fact, disseminate disinformation about how to respond to the danger of this disease, which is much worse, of course.
Indeed. He's politicized the crisis and helped Xi Jinping and the Chinese shirk responsibilities for the wrongdoings, the mistakes, and the incompetence at the outset of the outbreak. And they've also defended the Chinese government's gross violation of human rights, as well as their in the Wuhan lockdown originally, and then in other matters.
And continue to do so, as best I can tell. Again, our guest is Dr. Bradley Thayer. Let me just ask you about one other related point, if I can. Again, you've been warning about this further manifestation of sort of China's social imperialism, namely the idea of a, quote, Silk Road of healthcare. What does that involve, and what are the implications if the Chinese are successful with it?
But what it means is the Chinese, through their historical, the Silk Road to Europe and to Africa, is embodied in the modern Belt and Road Initiative, which is their effort to gain control, economic influence, political influence, and in time, diplomatic and military influence in other countries. The medical aspect of that, the medical Silk Road, is the fact that lamentably and inexcusably, we have allowed the production of medical equipment and of pharmaceuticals, and Rosemary Gibson, of course, has done outstanding work on this issue, to be sourced in China, to be produced in China and then exported to the rest of the world, introducing a huge vulnerability to the United States, the American people, and people around the world. We have, in essence, given the Chinese control over key pharmaceutical and personal protective equipment and other medical supplies, which is an outrageous situation that we have developed, but developed as a result of economic interests, as a result of globalization and economic interests with China, which allowed these goods to be produced there at a cheaper cost rather than in the United States and in the West. And now, of course, we're paying the price for that. And the vulnerability that we're now facing and potential shortages in every aspect reveals the folly of that decision and the gross incompetence.
If there is any silver lining to this disastrous pandemic, it is that these kinds of insights are now very much top of mind for lots of Americans. In fact, I was very heartened to hear the president yesterday talking about the imperative need for secure supply chains and a manufacturing base that's obviously under our own control here, a sovereign entity in the United States. We need to be striving for that. You have been raising the alarm about why, in the face of, among other things, the danger posed by Han centrism. That is, of course, again, the subtitle of the important book by Dr. Bradley Thayer, How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics, required reading for us all. Dr. Thayer, thank you very much for joining us today. Come back to us again soon if you would. This is a very, very important time for your great work. We appreciate it greatly. Next up, we'll speak with Fred Flights about the need to dispense with the services of the Director of National Intelligence. Right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by the president of the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional with time as a Central Intelligence Agency analyst, a member of the State Department and House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the National Security Council, much of it spent under the supervision of John Bolton, a man who I have had a chance to get to know and work with closely for a long time and admire greatly. He is the author of a really important piece born of much of his experience that we'll be talking about in the course of this segment. It appeared in the Washington Times. And first, let me welcome back Fred Flights, and then we'll get into that topic. Fred, it's good to have you back, as always. So you were under consideration by President Trump for the position of the Director of National Intelligence. I personally am delighted that you are still with the Center for Security Policy, but the nation may be the worse for you not being at the DNI's role. But you have written this piece, Fred, in which you said something, I think not for the first time, but certainly in a very, very important way, that there is no need for a director of national intelligence. Talk about why you've reached that conclusion and on what basis.
Well, Frank, it's good to be here. I want to state up front that this is advice that I've personally given to the president when he was asking about the director of national intelligence role. And he's well aware that there's a lot of problems with this position, with bloat, with politicization, with duplication. But I wrote this piece right now because there's been a lot of complaining and op-eds by former CIA Director John Brennan and former Director of National Intelligence Clapper that the president is wrong to be cutting back the ODNI, the Office of the DNI bureaucracy, and that he's letting go some significant people who are helping keep our nation safe. He's cutting back a vital national security organization. The fact is, Frank, I worked on the House Intelligence Committee staff, and I worked for the CIA and at the State Department, and I found that this ODNI bureaucracy is huge. It duplicates what the intelligence community is doing. It has set up another layer of bureaucracy that's made our intelligence much slower, much less efficient, much more risk averse. I remember I would be in a committee of the House Intelligence Committee, classified committee, and after the ODNI was set up, they would send so many witnesses for the witness table, there weren't enough room for them. And they brought so many aides, we couldn't fit them all into the hearing room. So I'm just urging something that I think that needs to be done. We didn't need this position. The intelligence community worked quite well when the CIA headed up the entire intelligence community. And the argument that, well, the intelligence community is too large for the CIA director to run it, the president runs the whole government. I mean, that's a lot larger and more complicated than the intelligence community. We need to streamline, get rid of the duplication. I know that's going to be difficult. Some of it can't be done without legislation, but there's a lot the president could do right now to cut back this behemoth, which is making us less safe.
I couldn't agree more, Fred. And I took very much this position back when they were setting up the DNI in the Congress back in 2004. It seemed inevitable that there was going to be just another layer of bureaucracy. There was going to be bloat. But honestly, until your piece, I hadn't realized the magnitude of this. You quote a former assistant director of the FBI, Ken Brock, as saying there are now 1,500 senior executive service billets associated with the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And he makes the comparison to his former agency, which is 20 times larger than that office, and it only has 200 to 300 SES positions. Now, some of this may be in the process of being whittled down a bit, but that is staggering, Fred. How could it be other than a bureaucratic impediment to good, you know, efficient government? And give us some examples of the kinds of things that under this so-called oversight mechanism we've gotten really wrong that are fundamentally problematic from an intelligence point of view as well as a national security one.
Well, I'll add to that that I had an aerial shot in an earlier version of this op-ed of the ODNI headquarters near Tyson's Corner, Virginia. It's unbelievable. It's huge. And I remember when I visited it right after it was set up, and I wondered to myself, there's thousands of people here. What do they do? And I still don't know what they do. 10 years later, when I was on the committee, the House Intelligence Committee, I worked with members to cap the size of that staff. And I imagine it's doubled many times since that happened. It missed the Arab Spring. It missed many serious instances of terrorism, including the underwear bomber. One reason for the DNI was to get intelligence agencies to share information, and it has utterly failed. What it has become instead is an organization that saps resources, has taken up top billets within the intelligence bureaucracy. I have spoken to station chiefs around the world in embassies, and they're just fed up with the DNI because they're constantly sending large delegations of officials with nothing to do. And this has been nicknamed intelligence tourism. as ODNI delegations tour the world to basically do nothing but take up staff time of our CIA stations that are supposed to be keeping us safe. So, look, we could do a lot of good by getting rid of this.
Yeah, when you look at this, some other examples that you cited of real problems, have been missing Putin's adventurism and China's increasing aggressiveness and the politicization of the intelligence community, notably that infamous 2017 assessment of Russia's influence operations or meddling in our elections. You've been very vocal in criticizing these errors, and I just wonder, there's a cautionary tale here, isn't there, Fred, that this came about, this Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the DNI that runs it, in response to a crisis, the 9/11 attacks. Just give us a sense as to whether we are perhaps at risk of making a similar kind of mistake today.
Well, I believe that oversight of the government is the job of government. They should is the job of Congress. Congress should not be outsourcing oversight to blue ribbon commissions, to a group of unelected individuals who will may use a crisis, take advantage of a crisis to do things that would never be accomplished in normal circumstances. That's how the DNI was created. The idea of a position like that had been batted around for decades, but was never implemented because it was generally understood to be a bad idea. It would be additional bureaucracy. But the 9/11 Commission, which was not charged with looking at doing this, recommended it, and no one was around to stop it. There were a few congressmen, Congressman Ray LaHood, for example, on the House Intelligence Committee, said this is a very bad idea. But after 9/11, nobody wanted to vote against the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commissioners pushed this on the country. It was impossible to stop. So I'm worried right now that after the coronavirus crisis, there will be a 9/11-like commission that's going to oppose all kinds of things unrelated to the virus and impose them on our country because it's a blue ribbon commission of unelected, unaccountable individuals who would be taking advantage of a crisis once again.
Well, it may be a little ways off, but the cautionary tale point needs to be understood now, and maybe we can head it off. Fred, lastly, quickly, the president has, of course, instead of you, appointed on an interim basis Rick Grenell, and on a permanent basis, he's renominated John Ratcliffe, a member of Congress, to head up this office of the Director of National Intelligence. I understand that Ambassador Grenell is cutting back on some of the bloat in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. What can you share with us about these men and their abilities to try to at least make some improvements, unless and until the whole thing is swept away?
Well, the president has named hardline supporters who he trusts to approach the problems in the DNI, I think because of its severe politicization. You know, we forgot to mention, Frank, that the CIA whistleblower now works for the ODNI. I think that's very significant. And Grenell has put in place a hiring freeze. He's looking into significant personnel cuts. I'm certain that Congressman Ratcliffe will do that. I think Ratcliffe is a good choice. He showed his capability during the impeachment hearings. The president trusts him implicitly. I think he'll be in place fairly quickly.
Well, we will be watching it closely, as will you, Fred Flights. As always, I appreciate your time with us here at Secure Freedom Radio and the support you give this program to make it possible at the Center for Security Policy. We're in your debt. We look forward to talking with you again next week and to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.